You're listening to the Politics of Food on KUCI 88.9
FM. Gap while I reached around and looked for this piece of paper.
You're going to introduce Patricia?
I am. Patricia Kleindienst is coming up in a few minutes. She's a University of Connecticut certified master gardener.
Wow.
And she also teaches writing occasionally at Yale.
Yale.
And she wrote an interesting book.
We got two copies and we can't find either one.
She's got a copy.
Yeah.
It's called The Earth Knows My Name, Food, Culture, and Sustainability in the Gardens of Ethnic Americans. This is Joy Hout, and I'm joined by Nathan Callahan, my co-host. This is The Politics of Food. And also on the line with us, we have Patricia Kleindienst.
Hi.
And you're joining us from Connecticut today, am I right?
Yes.
Okay, we're just getting your levels adjusted here. Welcome to The Politics of Food. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Patricia, you, on April 28th, your new book, The Earth Knows My Name, will be out. It's subtitled Food, Culture, and Sustainability in the Gardens of Ethnic Americans. And in this book, you tell the stories of several different about a dozen different gardens in America, nurtured by immigrants. And you also write that you notice the garden as a force of resistance in America. Is that what you set out to find, or is this an idea that you had when you started writing this book? Or?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I didn't have that idea when I set out. I wasn't quite sure what I would find. I did know that I had an idea about the garden as a form of justice and embodied memory for ethnic peoples. So I knew from the beginning that my point of view was going to be political because it was inspired by a letter Bartolomeo Vanzetti had written after he'd been condemned to death. He was remembering his father's gardens in Italy, and he was writing to a Kansas farm woman describing this garden, and as I read the letter and began weeping, it was so beautiful, I realized that he was mapping a moral universe in the garden and describing justice. So I did know that part, and it wasn't until I actually went out and began walking the land with people that I realized how passionately their gardens allowed them to express aspects of their culture that they felt they had to hide or protect from the pressure to assimilate and conform.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Now, you are a master gardener yourself. How does the experience that you encountered with these people differ from your own?
You can't learn to garden from a book or a class. So though, yes, I am a certified master gardener, I did my certification 10 years ago, so I've really become a gardener more and more over the years. My experience differs because my Italian-American family on my mother's side, my mother wanted to assimilate. She had been coming of age when Sacco and Vanzetti were executed. It was a terrible time for immigrants in America and a particularly vicious time for Italian immigrants, who were one of the largest groups of newcomers to America at the time. And one of the Italians in the book compares the Italian experience to the Mexican experience. She said, you know, Italians were treated then the way Mexicans are treated now.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the answer is my mother, because she had wanted to assimilate, didn't raise me with this awareness. I came to it later.
Mm.
So my garden experience has been a renaissance for me, a reawakening. And I guess I'm the perfect example of someone who, in becoming educated and becoming a teacher and a writer in America, lost my connection to the land and had to recover it.
Could you tell us what it means to be a certified master gardener? What do you have to take, and what do you do to have a certification from, is it University of Connecticut?
That's right, yes. The University of Connecticut is one of the land-grant universities, and all of the land-grant universities, I believe, across the country, through their extension services, offer a program like this. Cornell is one of the most famous here in the East. And I had to go to a class that was 6 hours a day, one day a week for 13 weeks. We had a massive amount of material to master, and we had lectures and slide talks and all these readings. And it was a marvelous program up at the university. I met the most wonderful people. There were 70 people taking the class. And then you take an exam at the end, and then you have to do 60 hours of volunteer work. And I did my volunteer work over at the Florence Griswold Museum of American Impressionism in Old Lyme, which was fascinating. they were trying to reconstruct the gardens that the famous painters had painted. Mm. And so I was working there on that.
What was that? I was just curious, what was that like, reconstructing gardens of painters? Did you see any of the art in the garden?
What do you mean by see the art in the garden? Do you mean could I see the influence of the garden on the painting?
Yeah.
Yeah. I could and I couldn't. We were just beginning. A very famous landscape designer, an English woman named Sheila Wertheimer, was in charge of the program. So we were not only maintaining the perennial gardens, which were quite extensive, that were already there, we were also trying to begin to conceptualize how to do the research to find the letters and catalogs that the Griswold gardener had originally sent away to plant her gardens that the Impressionists painted. Now it's all restored. So now it does actually invoke the painter's world. It's quite beautiful and interesting.
As you write, though, Patricia, this is quite a contrast, this sort of a few generations removed approach to horticulture and agriculture. We throw research at it. We take classes. But many of the immigrants you write about in your book, they just stick their hands in the dirt and they plant something that they know how to grow.
Yes. They do.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I really do feel that this is their birthright. They learn this. What I heard over and over again is that they can never remember a time when they didn't know it. And most of them don't remember a time when they didn't have their hands in the soil or see their parents have their hands in the soil. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a part of their traditional cultures, whether they come from Europe or Asia, or for Native Americans, especially in the Southwest, and the Iroquois person, in Clayton Bracoupe, who's the head of the Traditional Native Farming Association. So, yes, it's like a second nature to them. It's a deep, deep part of who they are as people. And the interesting thing to me was that a lot of them did not see this as knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I discovered some very curious things about American culture doing this book. Mm. I discovered that something very strange has happened to the idea of the garden and the very word garden. Because when I would ask people, do you have a garden, they'd say, oh, no, I just grow food. So I thought, you know, the garden has been sort of moved into this realm of a form of conspicuous consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, your garden is like your social calling card in a lot of ways. You know, it's an ornamental garden. It's a garden that's meant to be seen. And certainly I enjoy beautiful flowers and fruit trees as much as anyone. But the idea that people would say, no, I don't have a garden, I only grow food, struck me as really strange.
Well, I think maybe the garden as a word has been co-opted to mean that you have leisure.
Exactly. Leisure and money.
Mm-hmm.
So they're thinking in terms of an elite garden. And so a lot of people, like, for example, Loretta Frescas in the first chapter, at one point she said, you know, I never knew how much I knew until all these Anglo-scientists at Los Alamos started asking me, well, could you help me plant something? What should I grow? What grows here anyway? So
that comes up in several different stories that you write about where someone raised in as a Western agriculturalist wants to know actually really how to grow something. And so they go find someone who has.
That's right. That's right. And also those are the people who keep their seeds. One of the other things that I was struck by is these people are all seed savers because most of them come from very humble backgrounds, and they know what hunger is. They know what it means to be poor. And their tradition was you don't spend money on a garden. That defeats the purpose of a garden. You know, you save your seeds generation after generation after generation, and they all have stories, and they become part of your family. And you give seeds as gifts for weddings, for births. When a new immigrant comes over and they have nothing, you give them slips of grapevines, you give them tomatoes. You share. You know, you share.
We're speaking with Patricia Kleindienst, the author of The Earth Knows My Name. And, you know, I had just a question. I've always wondered, I've seen this happen, gardeners or tasting the soil, actually taking a bite out of the soil.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, that was something that I would, as a boy, I would have probably been smacked for doing, eating something that was dirty. And what is the taste that they're going for? What's going on there when they taste the soil? Do you know?
That's a great question. I'm not exactly sure what they're tasting for because I'm by no means as expert as they, but they're tasting, I would guess, they have an instinct in them because they were raised to know the taste for what the chemical composition of that soil is. Mm-hmm. You know, is it acid? Is it base? Is it ready? Is it ready to be planted? Is it sour? Is it sweet? A really good, rich, healthy soil doesn't stink, you know, mm-hmm. and it's very crumbly, and it shouldn't have a nasty taste at all.
Mm-hmm. It's, you
know,
almost...
it should really sort of melt in your mouth. And I love that what you said because, you know, we used to call it dirt.
Yeah.
Dirt.
Yeah.
Now,
so, well, you know, many of the immigrants that you write about also, that's their first challenge is finding some, you know, well, many of them live in urban areas, first of all. Mm-hmm. And so what they need to do is start from scratch where the soil isn't so good. You know, maybe it's been under concrete for a long time or it's been, you know, suffering from industrial waste or, you know, and these are the scraps that basically these communities are built around. Mm-hmm. And, What were some of the challenges with rebuilding the soil, first of all?
That was a fascinating question that came up over and over again. Mosca Pellegrini and Mario Pellegrini, who both came from Italy, they were the most senior gardeners in the book, and sadly they both died before it came out. Mm-hmm. When they moved to Redwood City, California, the soil had been destroyed by pesticides and herbicides. It was so hard that a garden fork could not penetrate it. So they went out and they got malorganite, and they just, you know what that is? It's sort of a...
No, I was just going to ask.
it's a blood product that's been composted in so that it doesn't have any, it's sterile, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it's organic, and it breaks down that hard soil. And then their son had an office party, and they had crabs. So he brought over a truckload of all these crab shells, which thank the high heavens, but they're perfect for helping loosen the soil. And so they had all these different ways they knew of amending the soil and patiently one small patch of it at a time, planting something to get it to grow. And then Ruhan Kainth, the Punjabi Sikh gardener in suburban L.A., had the mm-hmm. same problem. And I looked over the fence into her neighbor's yard, and one was a swimming pool surrounded by indoor-outdoor carpeting, so there was nothing growing there.
You know, that was a really striking passage in the book,
yeah.
actually.
And the
yeah.
other one has this sort of strictly marching lawn that's 1 inch high and perfectly green going to the fence. So what she did is she started planting trees from seed, and as their roots penetrated, they would loosen the soil and aerate the soil, and then worms could come. And when the trees drop their leaves, that becomes natural organic fertilizer for the tree. But the interesting thing is to just stand there and think, how did she know that?
Mm-hmm.
She'd never been allowed to have a garden in Delhi because she came from an elite family and women didn't do that. So she learned from the Hindu gardener who she called Mali. And she loved gardening and she would follow him around and he'd say to her, "See, baby, this is how we prune a tree. This is how we plant a seed." And she didn't get a chance to do it till she came to the United States. And you should see her garden. It's a jungle. It's magnificent.
Well, we're very close by, as a matter of fact.
We actually will.
Oh, good.
So you're going to be speaking in Fullerton at
yes,
the Fullerton Arboretum on June the 15th. That's a Thursday. And that's very close to this Punjabi garden that you
yes,
mentioned?
Yes, it is. In fact, I'm going to be reading from the chapter about Ruhan to honor her and her tradition.
Well, we're looking forward to that. I don't know if you know this, but UCI is only about maybe a half an hour drive from Fullerton.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
I'm really thrilled. She's a trained economist, and she teaches science in public school now, and she keeps chickens. She keeps bees. She grows neem trees from seeds. She grows sugar cane and uses the husks for mulch.
Now,
it's
these,
amazing.
These neem trees, what also struck me about this, there's so much in your book. I have to just glow about it for a second. Because
oh, thank you. Go ahead, glow.
I was so excited to receive it because it's such the perfect antidote to all of the anxiety that you can – that can well up in you as you start to notice how our urban cities are crumbling and our industrial food system is starting to eat itself and, you know, ecology is, you know, dwindling because of the way that we grow our food. And there's so many stories of hope, and but it's not about, you know, going to get a PhD to figure out how to solve the problem. It's just you see all these examples of just planting something.
Yes. And I loved the passage that I learned from Sir Albert Howard when, you know, he had a PhD and he was a mycologist and he got sent over to India, you know, thinking the Imperial British government sent him thinking he would, you know, teach the poor peasants how to farm. And, and he writes eloquently in his books about how without the benefit of, and then he has this long list of specialists, these peasants have kept their land and their animals and their crops healthier than anyone I know knows how to do. How did they do it? And they became his professors, he said. Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, go ahead.
And also in these, in this act of gardening, you know, as this woman in Fullerton, you write that the first thing she planted was a neem tree, which has enormous symbolism for Indian culture.
Yes.
And so what also happens is you nurture a new place for this culture to thrive.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And you bring a set of values and you bring a symbolic structure with you as well. You know, I was so inspired and moved by reading Aldo Leopold in Writing This Land. And one of the things he says is that some of the most important land uses have only spiritual or aesthetic yields. And he was thinking of wilderness, mm-hmm. but I'm doing that for gardens. And it's just very, very important to understand that. One of the things he said late in a Sand County Almanac, which I see as a war book, and the more aware he became of Nazi Germany and what war technology on the land was doing to us, the more he was distinguishing between science and technology and the imagination. There's this wonderful moment when he says, science is about the creation of exercise and exercise of power. Mm. But what about the creation and exercise of wonder, of respect for workmanship in nature? Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see in Rujan's garden, in Moscow's garden, in the Native American gardens, in the gardens of these Puerto Rican inner-city gardeners, the sense of wonder and respect and workmanship. And you can contrast that with our jadedness, our disrespect, and our lack of skill, you know. So I feel that if we began to learn to do what these gardeners do and to think the way they think, we wouldn't be filled with despair and fear in the way we are right now. We would begin to have a connection to the land. We would love it. It would move us. And a whole lot of other things that mass cultures persuaded us to believe, we would be less inclined to believe and buy into, I think.
Well, that's a great thought.
Yeah.
I hope so.
I can't think of anything to say. I'm just sort of, I'm still glowing.
Well, you know, thanks. And can I add one more thing that Leopold said that was very important to me?
Absolutely.
The real substance of conservatism, he wrote, this lies not in the physical projects of government, but in the mental processes of citizens. I'll say it again. The real substance of conservation lies not in the physical projects of government, but in the mental processes of citizens. So his idea that if citizens enjoyed nature, reconnected with nature, whether it's wilderness or in this case gardening or farming, that would change their minds and hearts, you know. Government projects are great if they're for conservation, though we wouldn't know what that's like right now in America. But if you can change people's hearts and minds, the only real change, he writes, is the change that's actually happening on the land. And so when I met these Puerto Rican migrant workers, retired migrant workers, who had these little community garden plots where they were growing organic food, I was so profoundly moved. For the first time in their life in America, they're growing healthy food and they're feeding themselves and their family.
This is another striking section of the book where his name is Alejandro Marrero.
Yes. He's planting beans.
He's planting beans, and this is a man who has what it's called stoop labor.
Stoop labor, yeah.
Do I have that right? For his entire adolescent and adult life, he has been bent over in a field growing homogenized food for other people, mm-hmm. and he's been too poor basically to feed himself, and now for the first time, you know, you'd think that he would run away from the whole thing. He would never
right.
want to work the land again,
but
instead he's reinvigorating his entire community.
Oh, it's amazing. And the love. He's 73, and the thing that was so striking to me, I learned all these things about food and gardens I had never known before. He said to me, oh, asparagus was the worst. Now, how many people right now are rushing out to buy their first fresh green asparagus of the spring? And imagine, let's think about it for a minute. Let's mm-hmm. connect the food, the asparagus we're rinsing under our faucet, to the fact that this man leans over and puts his hand to his back and shows me how he picked asparagus. And he just said, oh, it was the worst. And I said, how long were the rows? And he pointed across town to this clock tower on a hill. He said, from here to that clock tower. Mm. It was so striking to me. And I just can't taste asparagus the same way again.
Well, as industrialized as we've come to see our food, you know, there's so much processing on the far end of it, on the retail end of it, mm-hmm. that we tend to forget how much of it is hand cared for.
Exactly.
For very low, just horrible wages.
And well, because we want perfect food in America. You know,
cheap.
We want our apples to be flawless. We want our broccoli to be deep green. And when he described train loads of broccoli coming in and how they would unpack it from the train, wash it, trim it, and repack it on ice, hundreds of thousands of bushels of broccoli a day. It changed my perception of food. Mm-hmm. And then he's standing there planting beans. And it was his second planting. He'd already, harvested the first one. And I said, Alejandro, what are you going to do with all these beans? And he shrugged and he smiled and he said, give them away. Right. And I thought, that's the generosity of the poor, which I encountered over and over again.
Well, it's also to go back to what we talked about at first, which it's that it's a fundamental resistance and it's an upending of that power relationship with the land.
Yes, it is. Absolutely, and it's so empowering for them to have their own gardens and their own land. You know, and their resistance is not angry, it's not bitter. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so promising.
Exactly.
You know, it's a chance for them to restore their sense of community. And the thing that I thought was so profoundly important about Nuestras Raíces, which we're talking about now in Holyoke Mass, is the way in which it's affected the lives of the children. You know, inner-city Puerto Rican children mm-hmm. have been involved in these gardens for 6 or 7 years now. So I met this 13-year-old boy who translated for me. We sat on this bench under a tree at La Finquita, and I was asking the elders to describe the experience of being migrant workers for me. And one of the things I want to emphasize is the pride they take in their work, mm-hmm. the pride in how hard they worked and how skillful they were and how long they did it. And that was very interesting to me. So when we were all finished, I said, Candido, would you please show me your favorite part of the garden? He was very shy. He was a very tall young man. So we were leaving. We were walking down the central aisle, and all of these little garden plots are divided by wooden stakes that have chicken wire on them. And so they're really symbolic borders more than anything, but they're also used to grow peas and beans. And so he stopped, and he very gently put his hand under a pea flower, and he said, this is it right here. I love the way the fruit comes from the flower. And then he started pointing to the pattern on the leaf. He said, see the white lines on the green leaf? That reminds me of a butterfly. And here, the shape of this flower, doesn't it look like a kite? And I stood there and I thought, oh, my God, this is just amazing. He's 13 years old. He's grown up in the inner city. And this is the sense of wonder Leopold's talking about. Mm-hmm. He loves it. He can still see a kite and an elephant and a butterfly in a plant, and he knows how it reproduces itself. I said, how did you learn that the pea comes from the flower? He said, oh, I learned it here in the garden, you know? And they call the young men's group the protectors of the earth. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm. Something else interesting happened in this group of farms. It also was a place where women in this community
exactly.
could find a place for themselves. So why would they need a special place? And what are the relationships culturally between men and women in this community that, you know, the women were struggling?
I can only say what I learned from my visits. I would not say I'm an expert on this, but mm-hmm. Hilda Colon, who is the head of Latina Raíces, which is the women's group she started, Latina Roots, she said, you know, a lot of the women come over here and they get married, they have children, they don't go to school, Her mother was afraid she'd get lost. That's what she said to me. She said, that's what my mother would say to me over and over again. She didn't want me to go out into American culture because it was so hard and so competitive. And she saw what was happening to a lot of women. There's a lot of teenage pregnancy, you know, a lot of drug use, a lot of poverty in the inner city. And she just didn't want her daughters to get trapped in that. So she didn't encourage them to go to school. She had never been allowed to go to school. So Hilda got to go to public school in America, and she was just an honor student. She was amazing. And she had all this leadership potential, but then afterwards, nothing happened for her. And it wasn't until she went to work for Nueces Raices and actually went and took her shoes off and went to La Finquita for the first time and walked in the soil, and suddenly this light went on, and she said, oh, this is what it felt like to walk barefoot at home in Puerto Rico. And she started planting, and that power of bringing life out of the earth, it just changed her. And she saw what it did for the older women. These women planted the gardens, and they drew the girls into the program, and the girls learned to see the abandoned lots in the city as soil, not just as these crummy, dirty lots. They would pass a place where a building had been torn down and say, that would make a great garden, wouldn't it? So it was very empowering for her. She could become a leader. She could become a teacher. She could guide the young women and the older women. And she said, she had this great quote. She said, you know, the older women say to the girls, I want you to get an education so there isn't some man kicking your ass and telling you what to do when you get older. You know,
But it also nurtures in them a sense of political autonomy. So now not only do they see their lives differently, but they see their political landscape differently and their city differently.
Yep, exactly.
And their place in it.
They're more likely to vote. They're more likely to understand all sorts of things about property. For example, Nueces Raices, for all these years, has rented their lots to build these gardens. And now they've just put together enough funding to buy 4 acres on the Connecticut River, and they're starting a farm. Mm. They're going to have a fully integrated organic farm with animals, you know, pigs that can be slaughtered to make food, and fruit trees and vegetables and herbs and flowers, and they are thrilled. They are really thrilled.
Nathan, let's take a field trip.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's spring in Connecticut. Spring here, too. Everything's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty exciting.
It is exciting. It really is. It's a great time. I love the first moments I start putting fresh seeds in the earth. I'm still growing tomatoes from Mosca Pellegrini seeds.
Really? What else are you growing right now?
Oh, well, I haven't planted yet. I'm a little late. I'm going to be planting different kinds of tomatoes. I'll be planting squash and eggplant and peppers, and I probably want to grow some pumpkins and melons this year, and I'm going to try some different kinds of corn. So I'd like to expand some. I rent, actually. I have an apartment, so I tell my friends my savings account is in the ground.
You know, I love that you said that, because I think that a lot of people assume that you have to own some land yourself to grow anything, and that's not true.
No, of course not. In fact, a lot of the gardeners in my book don't own their own land, and they may never own their own land. Mm-hmm. I may never own my own land, but it's not going to stop me, and it's amazing how much you can grow in a little piece of land.
So do you have a garden, or do you grow food?
I do. I have both. See, we did that, didn't we? I started out growing flowers, and then I started... My first year I dug a garden, I dug up this circle where this tree had died, and the soil was very rich from the rotting roots. And I planted an herb garden. And so I planted my basil and oregano and thyme. And pretty soon I realized I was growing all the things that I'd eaten when I grew up, you know, all the seasonings for Italian food.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I had to have my tomatoes. And that's when I began to reconnect how much that food had meant to me, growing up in a huge extended Italian-American family on my mother's side. And the interesting thing is my father was the great gardener. He'd grown up in rural Pennsylvania, and his father had been a gardener too. So my mother grew flowers and plants, but it was my father who went out and planted, dug up the backyard in suburban New Jersey, put in this splendid organic garden in 1973. He was way ahead of the curve. He got organic gardening. He got books from Rodale Press. He started a compost heap. He got, you know, these bugs would come in the mail. I'd come home and I'd find these little boxes open immediately, you know, be full of ladybugs or the chrysalis of praying mantises. And mm-hmm. pretty soon we had all this life in the backyard.
You know, there's so much of this all over the country, and but it's not very visible. It is in people's backyards. You know, there's, you know, in Santa Ana, where I once lived recently, you would see chickens just running across the street occasionally.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, about two blocks from the courthouse. And, you know, but they're sort of like UFO sightings. You know, no one I know has a chicken.
Right.
You know, it's these immigrant cultures that have them.
That's right. You know? They have a very close relationship with their animals. You know, they raise them, they feed them well, they know how to slaughter them, and then they know how to cook them. And they don't waste any part of that animal. You know, that was one of the things I heard over and over again. Every single interview, and I did three times as many interviews as I have in the book, every single ethnic gardener at one point in the conversation would just turn to me and say, you know, you waste nothing in a garden. You waste nothing. You know, they know how to use everything they have.
It's a completely different paradigm.
Exactly. And they would say to me, you know, we don't call this organic gardening.
Right.
we never use the word sustainability.
They're not certified.
People did.
They're not certified, yeah.
That's
in
right.
Anything.
They don't have fancy words for it. And a lot of them would laugh and say, are you kidding? We were too poor to buy fertilizer.
Right.
You know? So now they understand, you know, all the wisdom of it and the usefulness of it, and they wouldn't think of it.
Well, again, we were talking with Patricia Kleindienst. She's the author of The Earth Knows My Name. It's out April 28th, which is about a week and a half from now. And thank you so much for being on the show. I've learned a bunch, and the book is so hopeful, like I said. It's really an antidote to a lot of the anxiety that I personally feel. And I wanted to remind our listeners here on The Politics of Food that Patricia Kleindienst will be at the Fullerton Arboretum speaking on June 15th, and we'll remind everyone again as that approaches.
Oh, that's wonderful. I really
appreciate it. And maybe we could talk to you again in June.
I would
be
absolutely
great.
Love it, because one of the things I forgot to talk about in this conversation was the chapter on African-American gardeners who've been completely neglected in our garden literature, and
true.
What an amazing story that is. So I'd be happy to share that next time.
Oh, I'd love to.
And the resurgence of Native American gardening, too.
That very as well. I wrote all that down.
Sure. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Okay, great. Have a good afternoon. Thanks
you
again.
You too. Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.